Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And you read at the end, it talks about how Kepler converted to Catholicism,
yeah,
right? And part of the reason that is for what O'Flaherty did, right?
Yeah.
It really, this reminds me of the shooting that took place to JP2 and how he forgave, you know, his shooter that tried to assassinate him, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s. And John Paul used to visit him in prison, correct?
Oh, I didn't know that.
That guy has also converted to Catholicism.
Art imitates life, and life imitates art. Today, Catholic writer and composer Jonathan Fessenden and I talk about two movies, one about Japanese Christians in the 17th century, Silence by Martin Scorsese, and one about the Nazi occupation of Rome in 1943, The Scarlet and the Black by Jerry London. Both beautiful, edifying, and fun on Almost Good Catholics.
Welcome to Almost Good Catholics, a conversation about theology and apologetics. I'm your host, Chris Odinets, and I get to ask interesting people who thought about the big questions to discuss what we know, how we know it, why we think we know it. If you'd like to join the conversation, please email almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. Today, I'm talking to Jonathan Fessenden. He's a Catholic theology teacher in Utah. He holds an MA in theology and apologetics from Holy Apostles College and Seminary. He loves the Catholic Church and also science fiction and classical music and film music. He writes for Missio Dei, a journal that aims to include many Catholic perspectives, often in productive and edifying disagreement, from a variety of voices, from clerics, from laypeople, from theologians and academics and other writers, which is kind of the point of this show as well. Jonathan composes music too, and I'll add a link for that below. And if it's okay with you, Jonathan, I'll add one of your compositions at the end of our talk.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here. It's really great. It's a great intro.
Thanks very much. I have a joke for you. This is a Jewish joke. The guy goes to his rabbi and says, Rabbi, I've lost my faith. I don't believe in God anymore. And the rabbi says, oh, yeah? Well, tell me about it. He's like, oh, it's terrible. It's tearing me apart. I can't sleep. I can't eat. I can't do anything. What should I do? And the rabbi says, oh, well, in that case, you'll be just fine.
Oh, this is good.
Yeah.
Much better than what I would have done.
So the point today is to talk about two movies, The Scarlet and the Black from 1983, and more recently, Martin Scorsese's Silence from 2016. But before we jump into that, I wanted to ask you about two topics. The first one was about your article about prayer, which was back when we were reading Luke back in chapter 9, which is, I think, now over a month ago when we first started emailing. But then I saw that today, in today's gospel, it's still the same topic. And today, Luke writes, beware that your hearts do not become drowsy from carousing and drunkenness and the anxieties of daily life, and that day catch you by surprise like a trap, for that day will assault everyone who lives on the face of the earth. And be vigilant at all times and pray that you have the strength to escape the tribulations that are imminent and stand before the Son of Man. So would you tell us a bit what you said about prayer back then, or what you've been thinking about it, and what guidance you have for the good people listening to your voice?
Well, This is a good question. Yeah. I mean, our prayer life is, well, for one, is extremely important. I'm in constant prayer, for one. What does that mean to me?
Yeah.
It means that it means that I'm constantly thinking about God, you know, throughout my day. Things that I do, choices I make. I think this is prayer as well, you know. Do I go to the Blessed Sacrament? Yes, quite often. You know, maybe I go in the evening times. It was really nice. The priest in my church gave me a key so I could actually go.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I have until about 10 o'clock every night. He gave that to actually the whole, by the way, the whole church. He offered one day at Mass, if anybody would like to have a key for after hours to pray for the Blessed Sacrament, he would give that to them. I think the Blessed Sacrament is essential to especially the Catholic, our Catholic life. We believe, at least we hope so anyways, right, that Jesus is present in the Eucharist. I know this has been a big topic in talks like Bishop Barron's brought up. I think you may have mentioned it to me and other people. You know, 70% don't believe in this. So I think my prayer life has to be centered on, you know, getting my faith stronger. I mean, you have to ascend to this. It was not always easy for me that I mean, for many years, I never even really gave that a lot of thought. But my prayer life, which came through a lot of even just, you know, doing the Hail Mary. And I think a person has to find a little bit what works for them to a degree too.
Yeah.
I'm very, I would say very Marian. I love the rosary. I keep the rosary on me. I pray it on my way to, I did a tweet recently that actually did pretty good and was like, hey, anybody pray the rosary in their car? A whole bunch of people are like, yeah, yeah. Some people, of course, were like, it's not the way I want to do it. And that's fine.
I do that.
Do you?
Yeah, it's my commute is about 22 minutes or something. So it's really quite perfect. And then I have it in my pocket all day long. And
yeah.
I teach kids, and sometimes they can be quite difficult. So it's nice to have that in my pocket just to hold on to when I'm, you know, being clement and merciful with some rowdy teenagers.
Right. And so the prayer life is like, and I'm sure that I'm so glad to hear this. I feel like I'm not alone here, you know? I love praying it on my way to work. Sometimes I rush out of bed in the morning, jump in the shower and get to work. In my mind, I want to wake up 20 minutes earlier and pray. Okay. But I usually hit the snooze button. So I kind of make up for it through the day. And I try to find my prayer life, you know, like I think the article, one of the articles we're talking about, which was pray without ceasing, right?
That's the one.
Yep. You don't, I mean, what did Christ say that? I have to back up to the article a little bit.
Here, I have your article open in another tab, and Jesus says, and I tell you, ask and you will receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be open to you, for everyone who asks receives, and the one who seeks finds, and the one who knocks, the door will be opened. That's how you start.
That's beautiful. Yeah. I love that. Yeah. Well, but being persistent then, right?
Yeah.
I think I talk about just the persistence of our prayer life. You know, it's got me through so many difficult times, or just any kind of discernment, any kind of discernment, you know, purchases even, you know, should I be purchasing this?
You know? Right. That's a good season, one for this season of between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Yeah, I know. Right.
Yeah. And then there was when I read your article, Prayer Without Ceasing, it was right after I had heard a sermon from Pope Francis, who's also sort of speaking on this theme. And he just says, like, just say hello to God, you know?
Yeah.
Just say, of course, it's in Italian. So he says, just, you know, as you pass by a church, just say ciao.
Ciao.
Just say ciao. And I think of, speaking of movies, you know, Robert De Niro in Bronx Tale, he always does the sign of the cross as he's driving his bus past the church. And I've started doing that too. And my kids do that now that they see me. Cause like you said, there's the Eucharist is in the tabernacle, and that is the real presence.
It's funny you say that, cause it makes me think of something, you know, I dated a girl many years ago, and her father was very Catholic, and I was a very lukewarm Catholic at this time. And I always remember when he got in the car, he always did that. And it really changed me forever. Like, it makes sense, right? To be protected while you're driving down the road, because that's really where a lot of accidents happen, of course, driving. So I definitely do that, you know.
Yeah. So I think of the Irish guy in Braveheart who joins William Wallace, who's always talking to God, you know. Mm-hmm. Like he, and even in a very comical way, like, oh, the Almighty says, I'll be fine, but you guys are in trouble, that sort of thing. And he says, you know who I'm talking about, that guy? Like, it's my island, that guy.
It's been a while for me since I haven't watched it for a while, but I am kind of familiar with the character.
That would be a lovely habit to get into. I also do the examine, and I also try to do the daily readings. And I know you're supposed to have a holy hour, but for me, it's like 10 minutes here, 10 minutes there. That's just, we're just busy people, you know?
Well, I do the same thing, Chris. It's, I'm part of are you in the Exodus group at all? The Exodus thing?
No, what is that? What is the Exodus group?
Oh, it's called Exodus 90. So basically it has the daily prayers, and it gives you things that you're supposed to do. Like you do like a couple weeks of a particular thing, whether it's fasting, Fridays or Wednesday, it just depends on which, one you're going into. But we always have the examine in the evening, which is, I started doing the examine because of Exodus 90.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love that. You know, looking at my day. Do you do it? I mean, obviously you do it in the evening, right?
I mean, I do it like right after I put the kids to bed. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then before I walk the dog, because I have a very nice evening where I get everybody to bed, then I sort of make the lunches for the next day, and then I walk the dog and I listen to a podcast or something like that. And,
man, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I do the same thing. Well, I don't have kids, unfortunately, but maybe one day. That'd be great.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the evening, I do the same thing. I think about it. I'm like, oh boy, did I fail on that?
Yeah. That's right. You know what? And I think like that's when prayer is super important, because we mess up all the time. And whatever it is you're struggling with, as soon as you slip on that thing that's been bothering you, that's when you feel the most distant. And that's a really good time to pray, I find. It's like, oh, you know, because it's not – we're always going to fall. We just have to get back up.
Yeah, you know, and my prayer life, it really has made me, I hope, more humble.
Mm.
Looking at my flaws and just, you know, I don't want to beat myself up too much all the time here, but you know, to know that it's like I'm planning on going to confession today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know Christ will always forgive me for what I do. I try to do better all the time, you know, but I think my prayer life definitely, it keeps me honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Then let's talk about these two movies. So I watched The Scarlet and the Black because you recommended it in your column. I'd never seen it before. The other movie you recommended is A Man for All Seasons, which I haven't seen in many years, but I knew it. But you kindly agreed to come and talk that movie over with me. And then we'll also talk about Silence, which I saw earlier this year, and then talked about it with one of the advisors to Scorsese, whose name was Makoto Fujimura, all about that and the book it's based on. So
I listened to that.
Oh, good.
It was really, really good. Very enjoyable. I learned a lot from that, from your podcast there too. And Shusaku Endo, right?
Right.
Who is the author. I just got the book here a couple of weeks ago, so I wanted to read it. And man, what an amazing book, but I got to give Scorsese major props here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know we always have these talks like, oh, the book or the movie was not nearly as good as the book. Yeah, right?
Yeah.
I really think this is, you know, one of those films that really mirrors the book.
It's so beautiful. He did such a good job. And, you know, in that Japanese style, like the Kurosawa movies, mm-hmm. where the fog or the wind or the rain is really playing in every frame, he has that. And it's gorgeously filmed, and there's so much going on in I should look up how much it cost, because he built 17th century Japan and filmed it.
Yeah, that's a good point too. This is 17th century Japan. I also got the Audible. I was listening to it while I was driving, and so it's about an 8-hour book, which he condensed into what the film is roughly 3 hours. So it is a long film.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, for those out there who don't want to sit that long, I think this is still a perfect film that you don't have to watch all the way through. I mean, you could definitely do it in two parts. You know what I mean?
Right. Or you know, 45 minutes at a time for a week.
Yeah. It's, yeah, totally. It's,
okay, so this movie cost $40 to $50 million, and it didn't do. I'm surprised it only made $23.8 million. So this was a budget. Mm. He lost money on it. So it really is it wasn't a commercial success at all. He just made it out of love, I think, and out of devotion.
I read about him saying that it was a passion project for him, and it took him a couple decades to really get the project off the ground. So, it's beautiful. The film is apart from the cinematography, which in and itself is just, wow. Like you said, with the smoke and emulating those earlier Japanese films. Gosh. Yeah. It's just great. And the story really hit the important parts, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So like you were saying, we are, and I think this is a problem for us, we're lukewarm. It's very easy to be a Catholic or a Christian in the United States. It doesn't cost you anything. And in both of these movies, there's a theme where the price is very high for doing the right thing. And so here we have Japanese people who, with very little, and this is historical, this is what actually happened, with very little time, you know, became quite devoted, and then they were persecuted for it, and often paid with their lives in martyrdom. And their faith becomes an inspiration for these two priests.
One thing I would like to say that I just found interesting about the story, when I first saw it when it came out, what year did it come out, Chris?
2016. It's
2016.
About 6 years old.
I was not familiar with the Japanese persecution in this 16th century or 17th century Japan, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially, from what I researched, St. Xavier is the first Jesuit to get out there in the 16th century in Japan, right? And it's actually doing okay. This is what I've gathered my information on. It's not till later that the Shogun, which I believe in the late 16th century, kind of takes over and really wants to crush the Christian.
Yes. Well, here I can help because I'm a historian.
Yeah, great. Oh, man, so please go for it. I love it.
Period of warring states where many different, warlords, shall we say, vie for power. And one comes out on top, and his name is Tokugawa. And Tokugawa Ieyasu is the first of these shoguns. He's who rules the whole country. The emperor sort of becomes a figurehead in the background. And he starts right in 1600, so it's very easy to remember that. So right in 1600, he takes over Japan, and he closes the country. And he says, no more foreign influence. We're going to keep things the way they are. We don't need anything from these outsiders. And I guess this is his grandson, or whoever is the third guy after him, who says no more Christianity.
So the film really asks a lot of difficult questions to me. You know, I think – for one, I love the historic. I never realized the film. Okay, this is what you would call like a historical fiction. I was talking to my brother about this, where although there may be certain characters that might not be completely historically true, like Kichijiro.
Yeah, Kichijiro. Kichijiro is,
yes,
is my favorite character by far in this, because he's us, right? He's the
yes.
So Kichijiro is this, he becomes their guide. They find him drunk in some bar in Macau or wherever they're coming from.
Yeah.
The Portuguese have a foothold somewhere in China. I think it's Macau. And he leads them back to Japan by ship. He's sort of their navigator, and he shows them where there's a Christian village. But as they're going through this adventure, he betrays them a number of times. The way you show your loyalty to the shogun and reject Christianity is you have to trample an icon. You have to trample a holy image called a fumie. And so he does this. He's done it before. He does it a number of times. He's always, you know, his family refused to do it, and they were killed, and he has done it a number of times. But every time he comes back, he wants to give his confession, and he wants to come back. And so he sort of, through this weakness and repentance, he perseveres to the end of the movie, and how does it end? He's still, you know, even when the priest remains in Japan as a laicized Japanese who is now seeking for, like, rooting out Christian symbols from Japan. Right? From the outside, he's completely rejected his religion. But on the inside, those two guys keep it going.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. I really love that. I mean, I think we all see some of ourselves in Kichijiro, right? Mm-hmm. At least I saw. And I struggle with that character at times. You know, Bishop Barron spoke about this film too. I don't know if you watched
it. Oh, no, I didn't watch it. What did Bishop Barron say?
I mean, for one, it was beautiful what he said, brilliant. And I think one of the things he was talking about was it's really easy on film to look at something and say, how dare you step on the face? But, you know, when you have death, real death facing you, I mean, look what, like he had said, the real heroes of this film are the lay people.
Yeah.
And I really agree with that. I mean, there's so much character. We could do character analysis on everybody, right, in this film. Father Ferreira, who's, you know, why they are there in the first place, right?
I think you should explain that we follow two Jesuits, Rodriguez and...
Garpe?
Yes, Garupe. And they are looking for their mentor, Father Ferreira, who they have heard has apostatized and... They don't believe it, of course. Father Ferreira is Liam Neeson, and he has apostatized, of course, and he's trying to, I think he really defends that decision to the younger priests. He's not faking it, or he's not conflicted. He's like, nah, Japan doesn't understand our faith, and
right.
So that's a big disappointment. Okay, so they find for what you were saying. I think they find
They're seeking him, but you know, I was talking to my brother about this too, and we were talking about martyrs, you know, how difficult, which is this is really in line with what Bishop Barron is saying about maybe not everybody is meant to martyr for the faith, though. You know, it's really difficult to say, like, would I be Kichijiro? I don't know if I could have gone on the cross like some of those Japanese laymen who died underwater slowly. I mean, this is an extreme persecution that, let's just be honest, it's scary.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Right. And then who knows what you'll do, right?
That's what Barron's saying. It's like, hey, when the rubber meets the road.
Yeah. It's like when I was, we just went camping this week, and we went out into the desert on the Colorado River between Arizona and Nevada. And on one of the days we passed by the Hoover Dam, and there's this really beautiful bridge called the Tillman and McCallahan Bridge that goes over the Hoover Dam. And it's really high above the river. And I had no problem crossing it, but then I sort of imagined, what if there were no railing? Or what if I had been closer to the edge? Like, I could feel my body. I could feel fear in my body in a way that wasn't in my mind. And I could imagine, like I saw a woman, a Japanese woman, a tourist, she couldn't move. Her younger friend or daughter or niece or whoever was trying to help her walk, and she couldn't, she was paralyzed with fear, you know? And like, who knows? Like, what? I don't know if you've seen Saving Private Ryan. Have you seen that one?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Spielberg, right? And there's a character who we sort of like, and like at the end, there's a battle, and he's just paralyzed with fear. He can't move to rush to help his friends. How do I know I'm not that guy? Like, I've never been tested in such a way. What if I'm the guy who just can't move or can't, you know?
And again, I think this is what the brilliance of the story of Silence, which of course has historical roots into this, as you pointed out, what happened in Japan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I look at Father Rodriguez, another character. It's like, I see a little bit of myself in all of these people. That's why I think that's, I'm not surprised, by the way, that the film did not do well.
It's long. It's Catholic. It's long.
You do kind of have to have a disposition for it.
Yeah. It's a movie that's like, it's, yeah, you're having a conversation with
Yeah, this isn't, you know, if you want action-packed, you know, no, this is a story, but this is a story of depth. It's got so much heart in that film, you know.
Yeah.
This is the third remake. Did you know that?
No, I didn't even know it was the second remake until you told me.
Yeah. Well, I started to watch the Japanese one.
From the 70s.
From the 70s. It's 1971, actually. And I love their intro, which is very similar to the book, which I think in the book, it gives like kind of what you were doing, a wonderful historical synopsis there before the book gets started, which I really love when they do that, right? It makes you understand what we're getting into here, you know, time period. It's like, oh, so this really happened? Like the Japanese were really persecuting the Christians at this time? I've never heard this.
Yeah.
But there's a Portuguese remake as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think it's before. I think it's – I don't know. I don't want to say the date, but I'm pretty sure – it's maybe I have it flipped, but I think it's before the 70s one.
Yeah. So in this movie, in the Scorsese one, everything that's in Portuguese is in English.
Yes. Right?
So when we hear English, we imagine it's Portuguese, and of course Japanese is Japanese. The villains in this movie are remarkable because they are so smooth. And they understand the Portuguese Christians way better than these two Jesuits understand Japan. And they speak really good English. I mean, they speak really good Portuguese, which is portrayed as English. And they're sort of suave. And that's got to be how the devil works, right? He has to whisper, right? The accuser has to, you know, like, so doubts and like, why are you doing this? Why are you even just relax?
You're 100% right. It's like the devil who, you know, can manifest in things that we hear in our planet knows the Bible very well too. So, you know, those guys knew the Christian doctrine very, very well.
Yeah.
You know, this is to your point.
Yeah, so the main villain is the Inquisitor, who's this old man and weirdly smiley, disturbingly smiley. So, and then he has this assistant who's called the Interpreter, and that guy's just even more masterful in his arguments and certainly in his language.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Those guys, this is where it gets kind of fun in some ways for film-wise, you know, these... antagonists and everything. Wow. It's
right. And so we live in a society where there's no price for our faith. I was talking to a guy in Pakistan some months ago, and he was saying like, no, we have Islamic anti-blasphemy laws where people get arrested, or there's real persecution for being a Christian. And of course there's parts of the world where you get your head cut off for being a Christian or enslaved and things like that. Places controlled by, I don't know, ISIS or equivalent groups. So we have this lukewarm problem. We do. What else shall we say about this? Because I want to contrast it with the other one.
The lukewarm problem, or do you want to go into the Scarlet and the Black?
Let's introduce the Scarlet and the Black, and maybe we can. Because conversely, Scarlet and the Black doesn't. I found the characters there to be much more straightforward. Would you tell us about it? Because I found out about this movie from you.
Yeah. Yes. I watched this movie a few years ago, and then I ended up doing a little research on it as well. So basically, this takes place in 1943, right, when the German army occupies Rome. Mm-hmm. And we have Pope Pius the 12th here, right? Mm-hmm. That's the Pope at the current time. So the two characters you have there is Monsignor O'Flaherty, right, which is played by Gregory Peck. Mm-hmm. And then I guess it's General Kapler, right, who's played by...
he is an SS Obersturmbannführer, which I think is a colonel.
Yeah, you're right. Lieutenant Colonel, right.
Okay.
yeah. who kind of had the occupation of, well, they're trying to occupy Rome, right, here at this particular time. The war, again, we're in 1943. They're really keeping their eyes on the Vatican, and the Vatican, who O'Flaherty is hiding non-Germans, right? Which it gets into the areas, of course, is the Jews and Polish. Because you do see some of the Polish people, I think, are the first people to appear in the film, if I'm not mistaken, that they, you know, they would hide them and put them in particular houses. Now, I, at first I was like, I had to research a little of this film. Like, just like in Silence, you know, we have a historical fiction film where there are liberties that are taken in film, as we know. But, you know, Monsignor O'Flaherty is definitely a real character.
Yep.
And as known for really what – this is what – I think this is a very pro-Catholic film because we get a lot of hardballs thrown at us. So it's good to have a film that's showing that, you know, we were – you know, doing the right things during 1943 as well. I mean, maybe there's some controversy in particular areas with Pope Pius XII and the way he was. I think, you know, from what I've been studying, by the way, on this topic, and I want to hear what you have to say because you're the, you know, the historian, that, you know, sometimes you don't talk too much, right? But I think the actions in this film really prove the love of the Catholic Church and what the Catholic Church is about.
Yes, yeah, for sure. I totally agree. And the conflict of what to do doesn't happen within a person the way it does for Father Rodriguez in Silence. It happens between characters, where Father or Monsignor O'Flaherty is just a classic Hollywood hero. I'm sure this movie made tons of money because he is, you know, he knows exactly what he's going to do. He never gives up. He never doubts. He outfoxes the Nazis at every turn. He's a master of disguise. Uh-huh. He's, you know, he's got to be in his 50s or something, but he's a boxer and he can knock down the Swiss guards while they're practicing, you know, and he's just so charming and such a, you know, Hollywood hero. It fits the tropes that we're familiar with in action movies. Whereas Pope Pius XII, he's not sure what to do because he's supposed to be this moral voice, but he's afraid of losing the Vatican and whatever standing he is. He's trying to be a diplomat. And that's, I think that's the question that I think we should hold for both of them. There's a moment where the Pope has got Monsignor O'Flaherty looking through like in the basement, looking at old art. And it's Monsignor O'Flaherty who says like, what is our duty when we come face to face with evil? Right. Yeah. And for the Pope, it's much more complicated. For the Monsignor, it's very clear because he's hiding these people.
Yeah.
And the Pope lets him do it, right? Because the Pope could say, you must obey, and we're not playing this game. We're going to be diplomatic, and the Nazis are just our occupying force. But he lets him do that, I think. So.
Yeah. I think this is, you know, this is a fun film, by the way, too, in many ways. I mean, there's some Hollywood, as you mentioned, there's Hollywood aspects to it. And I believe it's also based off of a, you know, book, which...
Yeah, it must be.
It is. The name of the book is The Scarlet Pimpernel of the Vatican. And as you can tell, it's very much following in the Scarlet Pimpernel kind of thing, disguises...
Right, because the Scarlet Pimpernel was smuggling aristocrats out during the French Revolution, during the Terror, right?
There you go. Yeah, exactly. So this is where that story really unites with that one. I don't want to jump too far to the end, but I will just say I'm going to anyways.
Yeah.
To me, the ending is what is the most breathtaking part of the film, the most important part of the film. I mean, all this... You know, it really talks about the Christian dilemmas, right? I mean, do you remember the end is really where, the truth really comes here. Now, Kapler meets O'Flaherty, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm forgetting where they meet.
Somewhere at night, right? On the battlefield.
And I want to say that. I think the Colosseum, yeah. And he really asks for forgiveness, right?
Mm-hmm. And a favor.
And the favor.
Yes.
But to me, you know, and O'Flaherty, who has a little bit of a hot Irish side of him, which, you know, can't blame him. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, how dare you? You want me to be nice to you now?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So we know, because we're watching it 40 years or 80 years after the event and 40 years after it was made, we know like the Germans are not going to stay there very long. It's 1943, right? Patton is already in Sicily, right? The Americans are coming and the Reich is getting rolled up and the Russians are coming and soon the Americans will be in France and all that. So we know like this is a short-lived occupation, but
yeah.
Kapler, I mean, he's interesting because he really believes that he owns Rome. He has this love affair with that city because he saw it when he was young and he always wanted to live there. And he's, you know, he's showing it to his children often. Like this is ours. The Third Reich will last 1,000 years. We own it. But that comes to an end.
Yeah, it does.
And as the Americans are, you know, coming up the peninsula or whatever, he has to leave and he asks, he knows he's going to be arrested because he can't evacuate since he's the commanding officer. And he asks Father O'Flaherty to please smuggle out his wife and kids to Switzerland.
Yeah. Which when they're having that meeting prior, right, in the Colosseum.
Mm-hmm.
O'Flaherty, I didn't really, maybe I think the first time watching it, I didn't think he would really do that.
Right? Yeah, I didn't think it would. I didn't think so either. This was my first time watching it.
Yeah. And, you know, then you see Kapler in prison, who ends up being in prison for the rest of his life. There's very interesting part. I love this part of the story. If you remember, and you read it at the end, it talks about how Kapler converted to Catholicism.
Yeah.
Right. And part of the reason that is for what O'Flaherty did. Right.
Yeah.
It really, this reminds me of the shooting that took place to JP2 and how he forgave, you know, his shooter that tried to assassinate him. Right.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s. And John Paul used to visit him in prison, correct?
Oh, I didn't know that.
That guy has also converted to Catholicism.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I've stayed up on this for years. He's wanting to become a priest. I don't know where this is at right now, but I believe he has finally been let out of prison.
So through the miracle of the internet, his name is Mehmet Ali Adja, maybe?
Yeah.
He's a Turkish assassin. He converted to the Roman Catholic Church on May 13th, 2007. May 13th, I believe, is the day he shot the Pope, right? That is the feast of Fatima, right? Which is why the bullet is now in the crown of that little statue in Fatima.
Yeah.
Right, they put that there.
Isn't that inspiring?
Yeah. The assassin arrived in the Vatican City in 2014 to lay flowers on the canonized John Paul II's tomb. That's amazing. I did not know that.
Yeah. That's what, when I saw the story, that's why I really, and this was before I even wrote that little, you know, small piece that I did very earlier on just on, you know, this film, The Scarlet and the Black, which that title I'm still a little confused about. There's some, who's the Scarlet, who's the Black?
Well, I think they're, so They're both, right? Because the Monsignor wears scarlet and black, and the Nazis, the SS, wear scarlet and black. And
so, yeah.
Right? And that's the famous line by Solzhenitsyn, that the line of good and evil runs through the center of every heart. Like, we are all the scarlet. We are all the black. Which I think is what Silence does, and this movie sort of... Like, if there's one character who actually changes, it's Kapler, right? He becomes a Catholic at the end. He asks for mercy and pardon. It's that guy, because he's so abusive. He's so possessive. He's, you know, the idea that you own a city, you treat it like you're like, and there's a moment where he's like, the pressure's on him to find where are these Catholics hiding the Jews? Where are these Catholics hiding the POWs? Like, he would fly into a rage and he'd yell at his children. He has a very abusive kind of streak in him, you know,
most definitely.
I found Christopher Plummer, I mean, he did such a great job. But I think that's the moral: is we're all Christopher Plummer. We're all Nazis, but we can all be Monsignor O'Flaherty.
We can. I think that's a real, you know, hard topic to understand. I mean, you know, we all have the potential, you know, to free will, right?
Yeah.
To be evil, to be on that side.
Right. So what's the difference between Judas and St. Peter, right? Judas betrays Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. Peter betrays Jesus 3 times, but one of them hangs himself and the other one, you know, weeps and then becomes the Pope.
Back to the Silent film too, right? Ichijiro really plays Judas too there too. He sells out Father Rodriguez.
You're right. For 300, whatever. 300.
Yeah, remember when he gives him the money and I don't want the money. So I think, I don't know if I should say this, but I think we can all be Judas at times, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I totally think, I don't think Judas needed to be, I think there was a way out for Judas too, for all of us, no matter what we do. Like this Turkish assassin or would-be assassin.
Because Jesus forgives us. I mean, he, you know, when our heart really repents. I mean, that's the thing. He never wants to see us, you know, for one, commit suicide.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, there was an interesting phone call. I think I was listening to Relevant Radio not too long ago, and there was a priest on there, and someone called in and said, well, is Hitler in hell? And I believe the church is teaching is, well, we just don't know. Now, I'm not going to go down this other road where we don't believe in hell, because we do. You know, we're supposed to believe in hell. That's this is the very modern thing of no hell existing is, well, that's just another topic for another day. But the caller was like, well, the priest was like, and to answer the question about Hitler, well, Jesus really doesn't want anybody to go there, right?
Right.
I mean, let's hope he's not. Let's hope that after that he did, you know, seek Christ. I don't think we want any of our brothers to go through that torment.
Right.
At all.
Right. There's always repentance. There's always forgiveness. There's a saint. I don't know if you know her, Maria Teresa Goretti. She was attacked by a guy and then stabbed 14 times and taken to the hospital, and she died forgiving this guy who attacked her. And this fellow went to jail for 27 years. And then after 27 years, he saw a vision of her and that forgiveness. And he became a friar, a Franciscan friar.
Wow.
Name was Alessandro Serenelli. This is back in the he died in 1970, and this whole thing happened at the turn of the century. So this happens often.
It does. I mean, it happened, you know, I don't have anything as dramatic like that, but my conversion too, back to Catholicism. I was very lukewarm, going back on the topic of lukewarm, for so many years in Los Angeles where I lived and did music. And you know, I'm just glad that God never gave up on me.
Yeah.
You know.
Amen. So how old were you when you converted to Catholicism?
Well, I had like never...
Reverted, I should say.
Yeah, I should say reverted. So I'd say it was about 8 years ago. So I was like 40, 39.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw so much, you know, I think like many people, you're going to go two ways. And I'm not trying to diss California here. Okay. You know, from my Californians out
there. Yeah.
But there is some elements to certain things. It's very self-centered, at least in the area I was at. It's very, very narcissistic. And it's, you know, it's just not really – you can see even with the Hollywood stars, which is kind of a little bit true. It's like you got guys like Mark Wahlberg now who are coming forward much later in his career, right? Mm-hmm. He couldn't have did that early on.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right. No, it's right. Especially L.A. where you were and everything is expensive and everybody's beautiful and they all spend all this time, you know, keeping up appearances and following the latest trend. And that's I think that's anywhere where there's a lot of wealth.
And I wasn't happy during those times.
Yeah.
The truth is like many musicians, I know this and a lot of artists, they're always, oh, I have to be famous or I have to put my name on this, you know. I went through that for many years, feeling like I had to, you know, have a name and all this stuff. And once I really just surrendered again to God and didn't really care about so much of the worldly rewards, I saw that my soul and the people around me is much more important. You know.
Yeah.
These are bigger issues than the cars and the money.
Yeah.
And the fame. You know.
Right.
Well, we don't want to give up on people that are. You know, might be in this lifestyle, though, as we've just discussed with all these characters, right?
Yeah, and I also think this, for me also, this is a more reflective season. I'm also in my 40s. You know, I think when you're younger, you're still playing that game. You're in the world, you're chasing its prizes. And as you get a little older, you're like, huh, well, maybe that's not going to work out. Or I'm, you know, I tried to do this, and what is it all about? It's can't be these things, because these things, even if you achieve them, they are ephemeral, or they slip through your fingers, or there's always something else you want to get next.
And I think I could have probably done that a little younger in my life had I been, you know, guided a little differently. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, having a good business, for instance, and being successful. But as we said at the top of this program, if God is not at the top of this, it lacks very much, you know, to me and to many and to most of my Catholic friends that I know, right? The lukewarm, you know, you can't really serve two masters here, can you?
That's right. That's right. And Bishop Barron says this all the time, right? It's like the Bob Dylan song, you're going to serve somebody. You're going to serve somebody. Even if you're, you know, even if you think this is your great idea that you're going to chase this dream and be successful in X, Y, or Z, you're still serving somebody. So there's no perfect master. Every master is not interested in your well-being except for one.
and me serving God now helps my decisions, helps me make better decisions. Doesn't mean, as you know, and all Catholics know, of this, there's trials, there's hard times, you know, but it really makes it a lot easier, a lot more peaceful, you know, with my decision making, you know, having a prayer life, praying ceaselessly, as we talked about, looking at quality films, you know.
Yeah.
My brother was just telling me, it's like, gosh, you know, it's almost like food, what you put into your body. What are you waking up in the morning doing? What are you looking at first thing of the day? Are you looking in the news and absorbing that? I'm not saying this or that about what you should be doing to anybody, but I think there is a lot of garbage we have to be careful of, right? Mm-hmm. But if we want to use the analogy of food here, you know, are we going to eat junk food? Are we going to put good food into our body? That's why I like this film Silence so much.
Yeah,
that is food for the soul through entertainment of film media, which, as we know, is extremely toxic these days.
Yeah, that's true. It'll sell you some false gods for sure.
Yeah, they're peddling at every turn anti-Christian, you know, things on, you know, just turn the TV right now, you'll find it.
Yeah.
So it's nice to find something that, you know, is makes you feel good after you watch it, even though it's a, both of these films can be sad. I think happy and sad, wouldn't you say?
I agree. The Scarlet and the Black is a, I wonder if it was like over several nights, you know, because it was made for television. This is back when some movies were, yeah. You know, like what's the other one right at that time? Jesus of Nazareth, right, by Franco Zeffirelli, a supremely beautiful movie, but also made for television. And, you know, you would sort of watch it over a bunch of nights. And this is back when people would watch, you know, the same. It wasn't, not everything was streaming. Everybody would sit down at 8 p.m. and watch the same thing,
right.
And then talk about it the next day. And so The Scarlet and the Black is made to appeal to a very broad audience. It has a lot of familiar actors.
Yes.
The other Nazi who's there with Christopher Plummer is a Bond villain. I think he's General Gogol from a couple of the movies also back at exactly that time. There's another Nazi in there who plays a Nazi in Indiana Jones Part 3.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot of faces and you'd be like, oh, I've seen that guy. I've seen that guy. The young airman, the young American who falls in love with the Italian girl. He plays Felix Leiter in a different Bond movie. So,
oh my gosh!
Yeah, he was in Living Daylights, the Timothy Dalton one. So I kept seeing these people.
I love that one. I love that one.
That's my favorite too. And even though people don't like Timothy Dalton so well, my favorite story.
I met Timothy in California. He was actually in the music scene when I was in a band. The lead singer knew him pretty well. He actually was at my house.
That's fantastic.
And he drove a Saab, I believe. Wasn't any rolling up in any big kind of car. Just he liked a very simple Saab, and he was very nice.
Yeah, I really like him.
And I told my friend, I was like, oh, that's like, he's my favorite Bond. And she's like, really?
Yeah, he only had two of them, and they're not the ones people remember. But that one is my favorite. And so that's Felix Leiter, the guy on the boat. And who like pulls up in the convertible and Bond jumps in. That's the young American airman who is hiding with Juliana. I think her name is Juliana in her apartment and her beautiful daughter, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I would have married her too. Yes.
Yeah.
If she would have me. But.
Yeah. And then I think the strangest casting choice is that Christopher Plummer is a Nazi right after he played a Nazi in The Sound of Music. And not only that, but his daughter is Liesl in this movie, and his daughter is Liesl in The Sound of Music, right? And
I didn't even put that together. Here I am flipping the names around.
Yeah. So, no, but it, like, and then in The Sound of Music, of course, he and Julie Andrews escaped to Switzerland from Austria from the Nazis. And here, his family escapes to Switzerland as Nazis from the Americans. So there's such a... that. And I don't even know why they did that, except for that it must have actually happened and this is supposed to be a historical picture. So they probably would have loved to name that kid something other than Liesl, but because her name was probably Liesl, they had to do it.
My gosh, that's really interesting. I don't remember this. I remember a lot of films growing up, by the way, that were on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you didn't either. I don't remember this being a big deal because it was 1983, right?
Yeah, I was too young. I was, you know, I was six.
Okay, yeah. I'm a little older than you, so yeah, I don't remember. I certainly don't remember this. I remember like Shogun being on. Remember this one?
Yeah, same idea, right?
Yeah, it was the TV nights where it would break up. And I remember my mom and dad were, you know, my parents were. Really love that one. That was a four-part movie or something like that.
Right. Christopher Plummer was also Herod Antipas in the Zeffirelli Jesus of Nazareth, who beheads John the Baptist. So
really? Yeah. I don't remember this. I'm going to have to go back and watch that now. Plummer's one of my favorites.
Yeah. There is an actor here who plays Father Vittorio, who, you know, Monsignor O'Flaherty visits in disguise. And that actor plays Pope John Paul I in Godfather Part III. So I've only seen this actor as a cleric in the Vatican in two different movies from the 80s. So there's just a lot of familiar faces. I think it was a time when Hollywood stars made just movies and they could be on TV, and that was fine. I don't think it was a step back for any of these.
And remind me again, who played the Pope?
That's John Gielgud. And John Gielgud, we should talk about him. I know we've been talking for an hour, but we should. So John Gielgud is, for me, he's a Shakespearean actor whom I mostly see every once in a while in like a BBC production of some Shakespeare play. I don't know what his big roles are, but he is, you know, distant, very philosophical and cerebral. And you can, I think he does a really good job of that interior conflict of what do you do as the Pope? Are you trying to keep this boat steady through the politics of the day, or you say, no, these Nazis are something different, and I'm very happy to, you know, like Jesus, I will sacrifice the body, because it's the right thing to do.
John Gielgud, he's just, I'm just going to say, one of the best actors. You know, I love the way he plays this, you know, Pope Pius XII here.
Yeah, and the real Pope Pius XII was a pope who comes from he was almost, you know, groomed for it. He's from one of these old clerical families in the Vatican. He was, I think, the Secretary of State for the Vatican or something like that, something very diplomatic for a long time. And it wasn't a surprise that he was elected pope, and he had this long view from that Italian tradition, whereas looking as an outsider, I'd be like, of course you're going to tell the Nazis what they can do with their rules, you know? But again, who knows what you would do? How beautiful would it have been if he could have done that? But what if, right? What if the Nazis won that war? And is it better to have the Catholic Church going, you know, in 10 years, in 20 years, in 100 years? Or is it better to say, no, this is evil. This is evil, and I'm not going to play.
I'll have to watch that. There was that Pope Pius XII film. Yeah, I believe it's 2010. I don't know if you've seen it. It's on that station formed. James Cromwell plays Pius XII. So
interesting.
Worth looking. We may have to do that in the future, huh?
Absolutely. I think we should next time, you know, in a couple of months, we should take up the other one you suggested, which was A Man for All Seasons, if you're down for that.
Yeah.
And one of my very favorite movies is The Mission.
Oh, yeah. Well, there we go. Similar to the Silence thing here, right? Jesuit missionaries.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm down. Yeah, we should do it.
Perfect. Well, then let's... It's what is it now? It's November. Let's reconvene in February and do it again.
That sounds great. Appreciate it, Chris.
Yeah, I'm so pleased. First of all, thank you so much for Missio Dei and all your writings.
They've
been terrific, and I'm just delighted to make your acquaintance.
We do have on Missio Dei too a book that's coming out on the Eucharistic revival. You can go to the website, check it out. We're still raising a little money. We're actually getting that book edited right now. And I love the writers that we have there. I just want to say thank you to those guys. They're doing a great job over there. Philip, who I met at Holy Apostles, we decided to form this together. We've been really getting a lot of good feedback. And really
I'm not growing. Surprised. It's a beautiful journal. And it appears in your email. And I recommend everybody subscribe to it. I'll link below. In the night.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So I just say thank you so much. And would you like to close with a blessing?
Is it okay to close with a prayer?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, great. Lately the St. Michael prayer has been on my heart a lot. Mm-hmm. I think just with a lot of things that are going on in the world, I think this prayer is still very, very important. So I'll put that in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Amen. St. Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our defense against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, O Prince of the Heavenly Host, by the power of God, cast into hell Satan and all the evil spirits prowl around the world seeking the ruin of souls. Amen.
Amen.
Nails, spear shall pierce him through the cross. Be born for me, for you, and hail, hail the Word made flesh, the Babe, the Son of Mary.
Chris Houdinius and Jonathan Fessenden recorded this conversation on November 16th, 2022, the feast day of St. Gertrude the Great, 13th century Benedictine nun, visionary mystic, and brilliant theologian. She practiced and contributed to nuptial mysticism, seeing not only the church, but also celibate women religious as brides of Christ. Our music comes from Josh and Margot of the Great Space Coaster Band, www.gscoasterband.com. Today, after Josh and Margot's What Child Is This?, I will also play Elysium, composed by Jonathan Fessenden, the Catholic artist I was just talking to. Our logo, the Dominican dog carrying the torch, comes from the website of the Dominican Friars of England, Scotland, and Wales, www.english.op.org. I'm Chris Houdinius. Talk to you soon.
This is Christ the King, whom shepherds guard and angels sing.